Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It wasn't cool to be, you know, polite or gentlemanly or any of the like virtues that, you know, young men would expect to possess in earlier eras. Now they'd all been thrown out the window, and it was about being as gross and vulgar as you possibly could be, and who could be more disgusting, basically.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map.
Hi there. So our guest this evening is Celeste Bell, who is the daughter of X-Ray Specs singer Polystyrene. Celeste recently made a documentary on her mother called I Am a Cliché.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi. Thanks for having me on this evening.
We're not too far from each other.
Yes, you're in the south of France.
I'm down in the south of France. You're in...
Yeah, Catalonia, yeah.
So last time I went to Catalonia, I went to Salvador Dali's museum in Figueras. Have you been there?
I haven't yet. We really want to go there and also go to Cadaqués, which is the village that he... I don't know if he was from there or he spent a lot of time there. But, we really want to go.
Yeah, he had a house there, right?
Yeah, he had a house there. That's on the coast. And Figueres is, it's not on the coast, is it? It's a little bit more inland.
No, that's right. I went there when I was in my 20s. I had a French girlfriend and we travelled down from Paris on a train with her cat on a lead and then which was very exciting. It was a wonderful experience, really. I mean, it was great. You look around and you could see all of Dali's paintings just by looking at the landscape. It just looked like his paintings, you know.
Uh-huh. So. Well, yeah, and as we're going to be talking a bit about my mum, I have to say that she was a big Dali fan. She introduced me to Dali's paintings when I was a child, and she, you know, tried to explain to me why they were very interesting and not just weird as I thought, you know, when I was about eight or nine. And then came to appreciate it myself later.
That's another reason why I love her then. That's another reason, you know.
Yeah.
So Yeah, I saw the movie that you made. I really liked it. I thought it was great.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
How long did it take to make it from beginning to end, you know, from like conception to the final cut, you know?
A long time. It was, we started at the end of 2016 and we finished in 2021. So it was 5 years really, wow, from start to finish, and lots of hiccups on the way, and you know, everything took a lot longer than we thought. I mean, Paul had a little bit, the co-director Paul Sung, he had a little bit more experience than I did, so but even he thought we would finish the film in a year, which was just, you know, really way too ambitious. So it took us much longer than that, and but yeah, I think that's actually when you speak to filmmakers who make these kinds of documentaries, and music documentaries are particularly challenging for lots of reasons. That actually seems to be quite standard in terms of how long it takes to do a feature doc.
Right. What was the most challenging thing?
Well, in terms of the music documentary genre, what tends to be challenging, and it also was for us, is the financial aspect. So, you know, you have to think about the music itself and clearing it. I didn't own the master's rights, and still don't own the publishing rights. So even though I had, you know, already relationships, so it was definitely easier for us. It was still, you know, that was a big learning curve, because that's quite a big job, because there's a lot of music that we use. And that will be, I think, for a lot of filmmakers, that's kind of a big hurdle. And then, of course, we had to clear all the footage that we used, because, you know, it's a documentary that uses a lot of archive. And so that had to all be cleared as well. So it was just like, I think we didn't really reckon with the sort of the budget and how huge it was going to be. So that, I would say, was the biggest challenge. And I think anyone making music documentaries will come across similar issues.
Yeah, we know all about that. We've just had a similar experience. We made an album, me and Budgie and our friend Jackknife Lee, and we started just before the pandemic, and we figured, oh, it'll take us about a year and it'll all be out. It's only just getting released now, you know?
Yeah, and that's the other thing with, this is not really related to film, but I know with music and friends of mine who've been trying to get music out at the moment is, you know, with the pandemic, I think it put a huge delays in terms of manufacturing. So there was that, you know, people are having to wait, especially if they want to release vinyl. You know, you've got to do everything way in advance. So, yeah, I think the effects, and we were still making the film. Yeah, like we were at the last stages of making the film when the pandemic happened, and it definitely... It kind of slowed us down a lot, but at the same time, it kind of allowed us to really intensely focus on it. So it sort of, in terms of the film, it you know, there were good and bad points about that whole experience.
Right. That's kind of what we found with the making the album, that it's like, in one way it was frustrating because we wanted people to hear it, but in other ways it's been a godsend because we've had a lot of time to focus on it, focus on what we wanted it to do and what we wanted it to be. So in the end, I think we've turned out something that's much more satisfying to us all. So, you know, I really, really liked your film. I watched it, like I said, about 2 or 3 months ago now. And I thought it was good because obviously you're very, very close to the subject.
Yeah.
But you also had, you know, I don't know what I would call it, a filmmaker's eye or whatever. You were able to be dispassionate enough about it for it to come across well, but also it had that emotion in it that's necessary when you're making a film about your mother, you know?
Yeah. Well, it was definitely a lot to, you know, a balancing act, I think, to get all of that right. And, you know, it helped that I was working with a co-director, because that gave us a little bit of space and distance, you know. So obviously I'm super close to the subject, but then Paul wasn't. So, you know, that was helpful. But, yeah, even with Paul, just finding that balance, I think, was, you know, like a long process throughout the filmmaking journey of trying to be objective whilst, you know, still making something that's deeply personal, and also something that's sort of true, you know. I'm not going to say we put everything in there, but it's definitely, you know, trying to be real with it. You know, that was very important to me.
Yeah.
That it was balanced also in terms of the storytelling, you know, that it's, because, you know, I could have made a very different type of film without maybe some of the, you know, more like raw, or revealing kind of elements.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean about that, because I've written a couple of books. The first book I wrote was a memoir. The second one is sort of a memoir as well, but it's like you have to make a decision that you're going to be as honest about stuff as possible, because otherwise nobody's going to believe it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think people cotton on very quickly if you're trying to pull the wool over their eyes. So that's what I liked about your documentary, because it was real, and it did feel real to me. There's a lot of people that were affected by your mum's music, me included. You know, Germ Free Adolescence, one of my favorites of all time. And we were talking the other week with Fat Mike from NoFX, which is like a punk band out here in California.
Yes, I know them.
And he could quote all the lyrics off of that, and he loves that record. And he doesn't like much, you know, like he's very picky about what he likes, but he loved that. So, I mean, you know, it cut across a lot of people. I mean, obviously, you know, she's your mum, and you were growing up when a lot of that was happening. But did the film help you realize just what an impact she'd had at the time she was doing all of that?
Definitely. Because I, you know, a big part of the film and the book as well, because we were sort of writing the book and working on the film at the same time. And the things that the element that both the book and the film share were the interviews. So we did a lot of interviews, audio only, and so we used those interviews in the book, and then also the same audio we used in the film without talking heads, so you don't see the people being interviewed. But it just provided like really, really valuable insight into not just my mum, so it was often, you know, mainly people that knew my mum, but also into the era, the time, the music, the wider context of punk, and then a lot of people who were just sort of influenced by my mum, people like Nina Cherry, for example, and sort of, you know, other artists whom my mum had an impact on. So, yeah, definitely learned a lot about making, about the impact that she had making the film.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real time of revolution, you know, and she was right there at the forefront of it. You know, you can't overstate just how much things changed radically at the end of the 70s, you know?
Yes, and also in, you know, what I learned was that in my mum's lifetime, and I think people who grew up in that period, just how much life changed from, you know, my mum was born in the late 50s, and then, you know, to when she was in X-ray specs, society had undergone a massive transformation, you know, like some, I think even greater than, you know, the change from the late 70s to today. I think, you know, the cultural shifts of like the 60s and 70s were just so profound, and that was sort of my mum's youth. So a lot of that kind of went into the songwriting and into her art, really, that, you know, observation of just how quickly it felt that society was changing, modernizing, and, you know, the consumerism and just things that we take for granted now as well in terms of, you know, mod cons. It was all very new when my mum was writing about this stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely it was. I mean, because me and Budgie are, we're from the late 50s too, you know, so we remember it, how it was absolutely a complete psychic change for the whole world,
mm-hmm.
especially, you know, like living in England at the time, because it was very austere in England at the sort of late 70s, you know, it still felt like you were still in the Second World War. And then all of a sudden, all this new music came up and a new atmosphere.
Yeah.
And it just felt very liberating.
Definitely. I can imagine. I was born in the early 80s, so I missed that. But I do remember, you know, people like goths, for example, when I was very little, and seeing them on the... on the underground and the tube with my mum, and just staring, you know, and my mum having to tell me off, you know, that it's rude to stare. And there were so in London, you know, still in the 80s, you know, you had just the clothes and the fashion and the eccentricity of people.
Yeah.
Of just everyday people, I think that's kind of sadly, I feel like that's something that's not really there anymore, like it was.
No,
I don't think people are so creative with their image as they were back then.
Yeah, I should have interviewed you for my book, because I just got a book coming out in September that's all about goth.
Oh, so, okay. You
know, you would have been perfect, but, you know, never mind, we'll do a follow-up. What do you think your mum would have done with, you know, the internet and social media? What do you think would have happened for her with that? I mean, just, you know, your own idea.
My mum was always very much what you call an early adopter when it comes to new trends and technology. So my mum had a computer when I was very young. So I had access to a computer at like 15.
Wow.
So that was in the 90s. And yeah, she had like a BlackBerry when it came out, and then she had an iPhone way longer than I did. So she was pretty much on it with technology and with the internet as well, with social media. So she was on Facebook.
Right.
I think she even had a Twitter. So, you know, she was definitely, like, in her later years, she was really into social media. I think she would have just gotten more and more sucked into it.
Yeah. The reason I asked you is because I was thinking that she was always somebody who liked to express herself but was probably a little shy as well, you know. So social media and stuff would have been a way for her to express herself, because, I mean, you know, the clothes she wore, the colors, everything, you know, it was brilliant. I was thinking, well, social media would have probably made it easier for her to be able to do some of that stuff without having to get, you know, in the mosh pit with everybody, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think she was, you know, it coincided, you know, the rise of social media, it coincided with my mum's sort of comeback, you know, just before she passed. She was getting into music again, you know, released Generation Indigo,
right,
her last album, and she was up for touring again. And I think it was just because, the whole landscape had changed so much that it was just, first of all, like playing live was just had become a much more comfortable experience, because, you know, the last gig that they did was at the Roundhouse, you know, so, and she was only up for doing those kind of bigger venues where it was, you know, just a little bit like more comfortable. And then with social media, she could just reach so many more people, like fans all over the world, without having to leave her house. So I think, she was totally into it. And if she was still around, she would be even more into it. Even like the fact that, you know, we can do podcasts and we're all in different countries. I'm sure she would have been, you know, maybe even doing a podcast herself. I will say, though, my mum was not one for caring about having, you know, like mainstream or popular opinions, and she was quite happy to be really controversial. So maybe she would have, she may have been cancelled by now, I think, with the cancel culture, because she was definitely gonna say what she thought, you know, whether it was a popular thing to say or not.
Right, well, that brings up a very good point, because I think one of the things that she was responsible for is being able to be a woman and have mm-hmm. an opinion and have a strong opinion and just be mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, just be who she was. And I think that lit the path up, if you like, for a lot of people coming afterwards. So she's really, to my mind, you know, if I think about it, when I was a young man and listening to, you know, X-Ray Specs, it was liberating. You know, it made me realize, hey, you know, we could all do something a bit different. And so it was very motivating. So I feel that she was a great motivator in that way, you know. So you're right. She, in the current climate, maybe she'd have been cancelled. But you know what? Who cares? Yeah. You know, really, really. Because, you know, otherwise we don't always want to all live in little beige boxes and be all exactly the same, you know.
No, exactly. The spirit of punk for me, like, obviously not having been around it at that first wave, but when I think about punk, it is that it's do it yourself. And in order to do it yourself, you have to be independent, an independent thinker.
Yes.
You also have to be kind of rebellious, I guess. I think nowadays thanks probably part to social media, it's a very conformist era, in fact.
Yeah.
You know, conformist in the sense of, you know, people tend to clump together in groups and tribes in a, you know, of course punk was tribal as well in a way, but it's very much, I feel like there is a lot less scope for self-expression in a weird way, because you would think that there would be a lot more. But I think, the social media has led to, you know, bubbles of people all kind of thinking and acting in very similar ways.
Right.
And that was really not what the punk ethos was at all.
No, I mean, something that a lot of people forget back then was that, you know, we adopted everybody. Everybody who wanted to do something different, you know, was our friend, you know, and that's how we'd start out. And so it was much more inclusive, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Somebody's being very self-expressive with you.
Yeah.
Who's that, Celeste?
Oh, that's my baby, Leo.
Leo, a good name.
Can you hear him?
Yeah.
Leo is 4 months. He's in the other room with his dad.
Oh, my goodness.
But yes, yeah. it's when it's bedtime, he's often... he gets doesn't want to go to sleep, kind of crying.
The good news is it gets better, but the not so good news is it takes a long time for it to get. talking about media and the people coming together and if you like the support networks, I got the feeling again from watching the clip of footage from the arena thing. There was a guy. Do you know who it was who was interviewing your mum on the ferry on the Mersey? Don't mention any names unless you want
I don't know. We did try to look him up, but no, we didn't find out actually who it was.
He was very pushy and very using words that you wouldn't normally hear in an interview. But it was, you know, because he had some good words.
Yeah.
But your mum just looked like a bit disinterested. It was cold and it was raining. I thought it was really nice. Again, looked like the tour manager came in to rescue the situation. But I recognised him. I recognized him because I'd left Liverpool probably by that point, but he was up and coming and a kind of a wannabe journalist. I don't know who maybe he's listening, but it kind of unnerved me and shocked me because what I realized there was very little awareness of being having to protect people.
No.
Against opportunists.
No, not at all. And I think a lot of those journalists, there was a kind of a style of journalism at that period, because there were lots of clips of interviews that we used in the film, where you're kind of just shocked. You're shocked at the interviewers, the questions that they're asking, like just straight up rude, to be honest. And almost quasi-insulting.
Yeah.
And I think that was kind of the cool way of being a journalist, I guess, at that time.
Yeah.
I'm also going to say something here which might, not be in my best interest, but it kind of true. British journalism, there's a vein of that kind of, horrible behavior in British journalism that doesn't exist in other parts of the world so much. It's always been a bit antagonistic.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very clear to me that I think a quote where your mum just said, I was just like writing words and I thought it'd be fun to start a band, and then it all went crazy, and it was very like it came across very loud and clear that it wasn't comfortable for her, and it was very moving and saddened me as well. But, thinking back, it was everybody was, what's the word? Available to be pilloried and dissected and investigated and. But not in any kind of good way. It was just taking pot shots, and it was really not very pleasant. And maybe, hopefully anyway, I mean, when our good friend John Lydon, John Rotten at the time, really kind of gave the press back what they were not expecting, and it was kind of formulative in changing the way that, if you like, the entertainment industry as it was, had set itself up. And now everybody had to play the game with the press and television.
Yeah.
And also, goodness, it's, Lol and I grew up in a Britain where if we mention one of the child entertainers of the time, we're not allowed to now because, Messrs. Savile and Harris.
Yeah.
Light entertainment TV presenters all found guilty of abusive behavior with children. And it was part of the closed shop culture that was guarded dark secrets. And it's not a good time to look back on, is it? There's no, it's a difficult time to look back on. It's a shocking time.
Well, I think, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that was wrongfully hidden and just awful.
Yeah.
I'm very glad that part of it doesn't exist anymore.
No.
The thing that I didn't like, though, really, was much more about personal attacks from the press, you know.
Yeah.
When they kind of don't know you, you know?
Yeah.
If you'd come from a background of showbiz or something like that, you know, you knew how to roll with the punches. And what punk did was allowed people who'd never been on stage before, had no real experience, and we learned on the job. We got up there,
yeah.
And the idea of missile throwing and spitting and all the rest of it, all of it kind of made good press, but it was really dangerous and frightening for people like your mum, and
that's right.
And the other, if you like, brave women that were getting up on stage and confronting that kind of a crowd, because it was rife, misogyny was rife, and it was out in the open.
Yeah,
as was racism and sexism, you know.
And I think, you know, like after there were some interviews, weren't there, with the Sex Pistols, where it was, they went on a daytime TV, you know, and they were swearing. I've seen some clips.
This is the Bill Grundy affair, right?
Yeah, the Bill Grundy interview. I think those kinds of, like, episodes probably established punk in, you know, or punks in the national psyche as being a certain way, and I think the way then people thought that they had to behave with the punks, they had to kind of mirror that in a way, and so it was, you know, in terms of like the crowds at gigs that my mum was doing, you know, it was just, it wasn't cool to be, you know, polite or gentlemanly or any of the like virtues that, you know, young men would expect to possess in earlier eras. Now they'd all been thrown out the window.
Yeah.
And it was about being as gross and vulgar as you possibly could be, and who could be more disgusting. Basically was, you know, was cooler. I mean, in fact, you know, all the pseudonyms that people gave themselves, you know, like
Havoc,
you know, Johnny Rotten or Sid Vicious. I mean, that's just, you know, perfect example. So it was, I think there was a lot of that, and I think there was a lot that was just fun about that, and it was just kids expressing themselves and really, really like taking the piss. But my mum happened to be a very sensitive kind of soul ultimately, even though she could give as good as she got, but, you know, and she'd grown up, you know, in a rough environment, and she was a fighter, but
right.
she had this very sensitive, ultimately like artistic soul. So, you know, her vibe, let's say, was really far removed from that,
right,
when it came to her music, because that it was X-Respects. They were punk in the sound, but I don't think necessarily they were kind of what a lot of people thought about in terms of punk, in terms of their lyrical or my mum's lyrical output, which was much more introspective and just a little bit different than a lot of the other stuff. So
yeah.
I think she was, it was just hard, I think, to keep playing along with that kind of, you know, the game, you know, to keep up with that. Yeah.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Assistant editor, Ben Miller. Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cure Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2023.